Joseph Saleh, and this is Living History. This show explores the rich heritage of the Brandywine Valley outside Philadelphia, focusing on the people, places, and events over more than 300 years, which have played an important part in our American heritage. Each show highlights a local town, event, or personality who's had a notable influence on our culture. And I'd like to mention that our call-in line, if you have questions or comments, is 610-701-9243. That's 610-701-9243. This day in history, February 15th. In 1898, an explosion occurs on or around the USS Maine, docked in Havana, Cuba, sinking the 6,000-ton battleship and killing 260 American sailors, leading to a congressional investigation and outrage against the country of Spain. This event brought about the Spanish-American War, a conflict which lasted only a few months before America was victorious, and later claimed several Spanish possessions, including the Philippines, Guam, and Puerto Rico, giving the U.S. her first foreign possessions around the globe. Although initial reports indicated that a Spanish mine laid in the harbor was responsible for the sinking, a follow-up investigation pointed to the likelihood of a fire aboard the ship as the real cause. In 1942, the British stronghold of Singapore falls to Japanese forces during the early days of World War II, the defeat a major loss for England, as more than 60,000 British, Australian, and Indian soldiers were taken prisoner, along with 70,000 American troops captured by the Japanese during the conflicts across the nearby Malay Peninsula. And in 1950, Walt Disney's Cinderella opens in theaters across the country. Based loosely on a Brothers Grimm fairy tale, the animated film depicted a young girl under the control of her oppressive stepmother. Helped by singing birds, frolicking mice, and a fairy godmother, she escapes and finds her Prince Charming. The film became enormously popular, with several remakes in the following decades. Alcohol has been around for thousands of years. The ancient Greeks and Romans often celebrated events with wine. Over the centuries, alcohol in its many forms, beer, wine, and liquors, became accepted forms of indulgence for people around the world. In America, the colonists consumed alcohol on a daily basis, as it was safer than drinking water from streams or springs, which was sometimes unhealthy. In fact, by today's standards, the people of the 17th and 18th centuries were fairly heavy drinkers, consuming several gallons of beer, wine, and whiskey on an annual basis. Alcohol became so popular, its overconsumption led to public drunkenness, family problems, and crime in many areas across the United States, breeding temperance movements and drives to ban alcohol from society. The teetotalers were successful. The 18th Amendment outlawed the production, transportation, and distribution of alcohol, only to be repealed roughly 13 years later following a tumultuous period called Prohibition. Sarah Minsky is manager of exhibition development at the National Constitution Center in Philadelphia, which will showcase a wonderful exhibit titled American Spirits, The Rise and Fall of Prohibition, that opens around March 3rd. The exhibit will explore the many facets and nuances of alcohol, its consumption, impact on society, and place in American culture. Sarah is with us today to tell us about this great new program at the Constitution Center, which should be of interest to people of all ages. Sarah, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me, Gene.
Oh, thank you for being with us. Before we get started, I want to say hello to our good friend Betty Muller, who's tuning in from New Jersey. Thank you, Betty, for listening into the show. Sarah, what gave your team the idea for the exhibit on Prohibition?
Well, very obviously, it has to do with two different constitutional amendments, the 18th Amendment and the 21st Amendment. So very, very early on when the center first opened in 2003, we knew as soon as we had the chance and really had built up our capabilities to create a really great, fun exhibition on the topic that we wanted to do it. And we actually originally opened this exhibit back in 2012, and it's been touring the country since then, and we're bringing it back. But around that time, an author named Daniel Okrent wrote a really wonderful book called Last Call, The Rise and Fall of Prohibition. And he came to us in about 2009 and said, "This, you know, it would make a great exhibit." And we said, we absolutely agree. So we worked with him at that time to create the exhibit. He also worked very closely with Ken Burns, returns on the documentary Prohibition that he did in 2011. So if you really come, if you read Dan's book, if you come see the exhibit, if you watch the documentary, you really get a really full story about the whole era. They're really sister projects that kind of complement each other.
Oh, that's fascinating. Where do you get the artifacts and items displayed there for the exhibit?
We get things from all over the country. We have about 50 different lenders to the exhibition because we are actually at the Country Center. We're not a collecting institution, so we don't have that many things that we own ourselves. We have a very small collection. So mostly when we do our exhibits, we get to borrow from great collections across the country, everything from the National Archives to local lenders like the Library Company of Philadelphia. We have some great things from the Mutter Museum, from their library, their college library. We have things from the Detroit Historical Society. We have tons of things from the Anheuser-Busch Archives. So it's a really fun thing when we do big exhibits like this, because we get to go over the country, look at different archives, and really bring the best things together that you would never normally get to see together if you were just going to one place, because they're spread across the country.
Oh, that's excellent. Yeah, just a little bit about the scope of the exhibit, its focus, its depth of coverage of the prohibition and the various issues. Just to describe it in general.
Yeah, so the exhibit actually covers about 100 years of history. We really begin the exhibit in the early 1800s, about 1830, and talk about the things that you were describing in your intro, how the temperance movement actually grew, what drinking habits were like at the time, what was the reason for prohibition, how did this even happen in the first place. So we actually spend about the first third of the exhibit or so looking at all those issues. And then we explain how the amendment actually got into the Constitution, and then we look at the prohibition era itself and look at the cultural and social changes that came about because of the era, but also what actually happened when they tried to enforce prohibition, and what were the different reasons why it failed, and once it failed, how was it repealed. So we're really telling a very, very long story that comes from the early part of the 1800s all the way to 1933 when the 21st Amendment was enacted and prohibition was repealed.
That's fascinating. Now, you know, a lot of people who know the term prohibition don't really know the history behind what caused it. You know, back in the mid to late 1800s, it was not uncommon for public drunkenness, even senators and congressmen to be drunk on occasion. It became a pretty big problem, leading to these big temperance movements, you know, the Christian Temperance Society and other groups. Tell us about, I'm sure you must have some displays that actually cover the temperance groups. Tell us about what they were trying to do.
Yeah, so there were some early temperance groups that got together in the early part of the 1800s, and they kind of start some different things, but they sort of die off a little bit around the time of the Civil War. And then after the Civil War, there were two really big groups. One was the Women's Christian Temperance Union. And they, I think one of the things I found so fascinating about this exhibit is, again, we wanted to explain that it wasn't just a bunch of, you know, fuddy-duddy people who were trying to tell, you know, everybody else what to do. For a lot of these women who were also suffragists, they really saw this problem of alcoholism as something that they needed to combat, because they really didn't have any political power or legal power. You know, they couldn't, you know, if they had a husband who was, you know, gambling, you know, their income away, they really had no legal retribution to protect themselves or to protect their children. They couldn't vote. So they really saw voting and temperance as going hand in hand. They wanted to vote so they could vote for laws that would protect themselves and their families and give them some legal power. So they really was tied up with a lot of different progressive issues of the era, and you know, I think that's just a really fascinating part of the story. You know, it didn't come out of nowhere, and they did have, you know, their reasons. You can agree or disagree, and you can say they went too far or how they went about it. So they're a big group. Another big group is the Anti-Saloon League, and they kind of actually end up around the turn of the century overtaking the Women's Christian Temperance Union as the most effective group, and they were very focused on this idea of the saloon, which is this male-dominated establishment where shutting those down. They were very close ties to the brewing industries, so they were really focused on shutting that down, and they saw eventually that, you know, it wasn't going to be enough just to have state state laws or other types of things that they really needed national prohibition in the form of a constitutional amendment.
Yes, so they were clearly successful in two things. One, actually getting the amendment, and then two, getting the right to vote. Unfortunately, the amendment is the one that was later overturned.
But
a lot of people probably are not aware that the suffragette movement and the temperance movement were strongly linked.
Yeah, they were very, very strong allies. The Women's Christian Temperance Union really advocated for both. They were, along with other progressive causes like, you know, school reforms and workers' rights and even vegetarianism, they were activists for a lot of different causes at the same time.
Very interesting. What is there about prohibition that you think will be of most interest to the public who visits there? What do you think would catches their attention the most?
There's things in the exhibit that are just eye-catching. We have a full speakeasy set that you can visit and learn how to dance at Charleston.
Do they serve any drinks?
We cannot have food or drinks inside an exhibition because of the artifacts, but you can order a story. We have a program where you can go up to a staff person and they'll tell you a story at the bar and things like that.
Oh, that's
so
great.
We have a lot of drinkware that's empty. You can do that kind of thing. So those are very catching. Of the two things I would say that people are always really surprised about, the one is what we talked about how closely suffrage and temperance were being tied together, but also that it was actually never illegal to drink during Prohibition. And people don't realize that at all. I don't know if I realized that before we start working on this, because when you look at the amendment, it says manufacture, sale, and transport. So this amendment was really geared at the industry. It was geared at shutting down alcohol production and the supply lines. And the folks behind the amendment, the folks at the Anti-Saloon League, did that on purpose because they thought if they outlawed drinking, then they wouldn't be able to get people to come forward and testify in court against their suppliers. Oh. They never wanted to make it the act of drinking itself illegal. They were trying to shut everything else down around it and hopefully, you know, again, have that ability in court to bring people in, but it never really worked out quite that way.
Yeah, very interesting. Well, we're about to take a brief break, but stay with us. We'll be coming back with Sarah Winsky of the National Constitution Center talking about prohibition.
Do you have a wedding, graduation, baptism, confirmation, milestone, or birthday to plan? You need John Surratt Catering, one of the most highly rated and preferred caterers throughout the Philadelphia area. They will be there to create and cater your event while assisting as much or as little as you desire. Planning a decadent, over-the-top company gala? Need help transforming your backyard into the party of the year? Want to wow your clients with a delicious luncheon? Then you need John Surratt Catering. All you have to do is call and they'll handle the rest. Located at 835 Lincoln Avenue in Westchester, visit them at SurrockCatering.com or call 610-640-2836. That's 610-640-2836.
If you had to choose a roofer, would you choose one with limited experience and knowledge, or would you choose a roofer certified as a master elite contractor by the largest manufacturer in the nation, GAF, a distinction shared by only 3% of the nation's roofers? I'm talking about GP Martini Roofing, who also does siding, windows, doors, and offers an ironclad guarantee that he'll repair or replace any roof for defects within its normal life. GP Martini Services, Chester, Delaware, Bucks, and Montgomery counties, with free estimates and consultation, and does both commercial and residential. Go to their website at martiniroofing.com for special savings, or call 610-873-1696. And also, financing is available with no payments for a full year. Now, what roofer would you call? GP Martini is the answer. 610-873-1696.
You're listening to WCHE 1520 AM, the Talk of Chester County. Stay tuned for what's next.
I'm Gene Pasale, and this is Living History. Today we're talking with Sarah Winsky of the National Constitution Center in downtown Philadelphia about the great new exhibit coming up called Prohibition. And Sarah, you know, we've talked a little bit about the exhibit. What is the first thing that grabs people's attention when they walk into the exhibit there?
Yes, they have a very dramatic display that alludes to some of the things you were talking earlier. It's we call it our bottle wall, but it's a big wall of 90 bottles that are lit up, and it's basically showing the year 1830, which was, according to historians, looking at a lot of the records and trying to piece all this together, it was the year we consumed the most alcohol in American history. Mm-hmm. The average American adult was consuming about 7 gallons of pure alcohol a year, which works out to about the 90 bottles of an average 80-proof liquor bottle.
Oh my Lord.
We have that. So you come in, you can see that volume, and we have a third of those lit, and that's actually what we consume today. We only consume about a third of the amount of what they were consuming in that period in the early 1800s. So it's a really dramatic display as soon as you come in to kind of, again, kind of break down some of those preconceived notions and let people know, hey, this there were things happening in the society that were causing these movements and issues, and it didn't come quite from nowhere.
Mm-hmm. Now, the exhibit, I believe I was actually at the exhibit a few years back when mm-hmm. it was there, and it has, if I recall correctly, it has a map of the various states and their rules, if it's the sale of beer, wine, et cetera, spirits mm-hmm. is fully legal or partially legal mm-hmm. or restricted and all that. Do you ever get people asking about the rules of in let's say Pennsylvania, which is actually kind of a little bit backwards compared to some other states because we have the state stores, et cetera?
Yeah.
Do you ever have people ask about that?
A little bit. I mean, it's a kind of what you're mentioning is a map we have that is at the end of the exhibit. It's kind of a little bit of our coda after repeal, where we basically make the point, which is after Prohibition ended, it didn't totally go away. It just went back to the states, which is exactly, control of liquor, alcohol sales, everything, was controlled by the states before Prohibition, and it went back to the states after Prohibition. And that's really how you end up with what the map shows is a patchwork of control states versus licensed states. So after Prohibition, about half the states decided to go with license, so the state would grant license to local sellers, and about half the states decided to keep, like Pennsylvania, controlled liquor sales by the state.
Mm-hmm.
So this map is showing, how that breaks down today. Some states have flipped it since then. Washington State famously did it just a few years ago as the exhibit was opening. They went from being a control to a licensed state. Mm-hmm. And we do highlight some of the quirky laws throughout the country. Mm-hmm. And the reason we have all these crazy patchwork of laws is everybody kind of looked at Prohibition and went, okay, we don't want the excesses of before, but we don't want all the problems of having this completely unregulated industry. So how do we do something in between? And various states decided to do a lot of different things, and obviously Pennsylvania is known for being the one of the ones that has been most restrictive, although that's been changing very, very recently.
Sure. The variation across the U.S. is pretty dramatic. For example, I lived in California for about 11 years, and you can buy liquor, beer, wine, just about mm-hmm. anything you want in gasoline stations, 7-Elevens. You walk around the corner, you can buy it at 5 different places mm-hmm. Compared to Pennsylvania, which is quite a bit different. So mm-hmm. so that variation is huge.
Yeah, and that's all legacy of Prohibition. I mean, again, with the 21st Amendment, the second section of the 21st Amendment says, basically this goes back to the states. So that gives the states the power to have all these different rules that we live with today.
Exactly. Now, the time period from, let's say, 1920, 1933, roughly 13 years, was one of increasing gangster violence around the mm-hmm. nation, bootleggers, et cetera. Do you mention that in the exhibit?
We do. We highlight that as, one of the kind of three main reasons Prohibition failed. So one of them was that, people just didn't really want to follow the law. I mean, again, you talked about this earlier, something that was a part of human history for going back into human culture for a very long time is fine one day and it's not fine the next. So it's really hard to get people to kind of follow the law when they don't totally agree with it. So there were tons of people, skirting the law, finding loopholes, and that, made it hard to enforce it. And then the enforcement agency itself, the Prohibition Bureau, was never effective and was never had enough money or funds or people to really enforce the law properly. But then the other reason why Prohibition really failed was because of organized crime. Organized crime existed before Prohibition, but it was always usually pretty localized. You would have, you know, an area of town in a city where there was illicit gambling or prostitution or narcotics going on. But then suddenly you had this substance, this illegal substance that people still wanted. So you had tons and tons of demand for this substance, and there was a lot of money to be made. So suddenly you have start having gang wars over turf. You know, people want control of different markets because, again, there's all this money, all this demand. And then you also need to start figuring out how you're going to get alcohol from one place to another because it's illegal to transport it. So they start creating networks of how you're going to get, you know, things that are coming in from Canada down into the middle of the country. So you're going to create these different agreements, and it just builds this organized crime network that didn't really exist before Prohibition. And this gets, you know, these turf wars get splashed on the newspapers every day in places like Chicago, and people just start really souring towards the idea of Prohibition because this is just one of the unintended consequences of it.
Certainly. Do you mention any big-time gangsters like Al Capone and others?
We do. We have a wall where we do have an artifact case with some different artifacts in it related to organized crime. We have a wall where we highlight, we create these like mock intake cards so you can learn about different people. And then we actually have an interactive where you can get your photo taken in a photo lineup, and you can actually stand next to Al Capone and act like you're getting booked right alongside him. So it's a fun interactive. So yeah, so we do have a little area where we highlight all those topics.
You know, it was interesting. I was just thinking about Prohibition and the government control. Generated the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms? Was that directly linked to Prohibition, or did that come later?
That came after. So what happened is, before Prohibition, there was actually, you know, a big thing people also don't know about Prohibition is that beforehand, alcohol taxes really made up the biggest domestic source of revenue for the government, outside of import taxes on imports and things that are being shipped in. So when that went away, they had to replace it with something. So that's actually how we get the income tax amendment. So we actually had to pass the income tax amendment first before they could pass Prohibition. But all that was being controlled by the Internal Revenue Service, which is part of the Treasury Department. So they create the Prohibition Bureau out of those same agents who were originally kind of going after people to get liquor taxes and collect those taxes. So it's all part of the Treasury. And then eventually it does become its own bureau, and then it goes into the Justice Department, and it moves around a lot. And around the same time, the Bureau of Investigation is being formed. So it's kind of more a part of the legacy of Prohibition that rises up after it, after they kind of keep shifting and move around these departments and kind of change their directive. So I think I don't know exactly how it's related off the top of my head, but it more started in the Treasury Department.
Yes. You know, the exhibit sounds fascinating. Again, I think I only saw part of it. I don't know that I saw every single aspect of the exhibit, but it is called American Spirits, The Rise and Fall of Prohibition, which will be at the National Constitution Center in downtown Philadelphia starting, is it March 3rd?
Yep, on March 3rd, and it's open until July 16th.
Excellent. Now, how big is the exhibit? How many artifacts, displays? What do you have there?
There's about 120 artifacts, tons of displays. We have these couple big, really big set pieces, like I talked about the speakeasy. We have a Prohibition agent office. We have a church set where we really talk about the rise of the temperance movement. We have several different games. We have a video game where you get to be a federal agent trying to capture rum runners, and you get to drive a boat.
Do you have any displays of stills?
We do have a still, an actual still from 1930 that was used by a farmer down in North Carolina to make illicit alcohol. We have a ton of artifacts, videos, interactive games. So it's a nice-sized exhibit. I would definitely plan to come spend, you know, like an hour in the exhibit. There's a lot to see and do.
Now, what is your favorite part of the exhibit? What are the things that you find the most interesting?
Speakeasy of the set. Actually, probably my favorite thing is what we probably consider the heart of the exhibition. We call it Wayne Wheeler's Amazing Amendment Machine, and there's nothing I can describe it that's like it. It's basically a 20-foot-long mechanical device that in 3 minutes shows you how the 18th Amendment got into the Constitution and all the kind of funky steps that it took, and it's all animated, and it feels like this big carnival kind of contraction, so it was the thing where we sat down in the beginning and went, okay, we have to figure out how do you explain the amendment process and how do we explain this particular amendment in a way that's fun, interactive, engaging, and it's just really mesmerizing and fun to watch, and you learn a ton from it.
I bet.
It kind of formed the heart of the exhibition, so I always will love that piece.
Now, that sounds very interesting. Now, the 18th Amendment, which brought in prohibition, is the only constitutional amendment that was later repealed.
Yes.
Can you talk a bit about why it was repealed and how it actually got repealed?
Yeah, absolutely. That's the last section of the exhibit talks about all of that. And it was really very quick, because when you think about it, to get prohibition into the Constitution, it probably took about 6 decades of activism. And then by the end of the 1920s, you know, everyone kind of knows prohibition's not working, but nobody really knows what to do about it. But then very, very quickly, the stock market crashes. And Congress looks around and goes, okay, we no longer have the same income tax revenue. We no longer have the same capital gains tax revenue that we used to have. We need more revenue. What can we do? Oh, we can bring back the alcohol excess tax, but we need to make alcohol industry legal again, because you can't tax an industry that's not supposed to exist.
Mm-hmm.
So very quickly, more quickly than the supporters of prohibition would have ever believed, or even its opponents would have believed a few years before, an amendment it comes a part of the 1932 election. Roosevelt comes out in support of it, and very, very quickly the amendment gets written and then to repeal, and it gets passed by Congress, and within that year, calendar year, it gets repealed. And it's really fascinating how quickly. One of my favorite quotes is the author of the or the sponsor of the 18th Amendment said in like 1930 or 32, the 18th Amendment has as much of a chance of getting repealed as a hummingbird does of flying to Mars with the Washington Monument tied to its tail.
Well, I think it had better chances than that, but
But that showed you just even in like 1930 how completely skeptical people were that it was actually possible to repeal an amendment.
Oh my gosh! So they finally did, and actually business and tax revenue was a big part of it. We're almost finished. We're just about out of time, but tell us a little bit about the website and how people can buy tickets.
Oh yeah, you can go to our website, which is constitutioncenter.org, and I believe starting next week we're going to have some advanced tickets available, so you can start going on. You can also call us at our call center at 215-409-6700, or you can buy tickets on site at our box office. And like I said, it'll be up through January 16th. We're having, and actually for the first month for March, we're still part of our winter warm-up sale, which we do every winter. So you can actually, tickets are a little bit more reduced. They're $13 for adults, and that includes general admission and the exhibit. So if you want to come out through before March 31st, you can get our winter warm-up price. But then it'll be up through July.
Excellent.
And we have other days that are free and sponsored days and stuff, too, that you can come out.
So just check out the website.
That is
great. Sarah, thank you so much for joining us today on the show.
Great. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, be sure to tune in next Wednesday, February 22nd at 1 p.m. Eastern Time, when we'll be speaking with Dale Mincer, a 40-year pilot with U.S. Air, who will tell us about the airline industry and some of his interactions with famous pilot Sully Sullenberger. Thank you all for tuning in today to Living History.